This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Peter D. Norton, Assistant Professor in the Department of Science, Technology, and Society at the University of Virginia. Peter Norton is here today to tell us about his book, Fighting Traffic, The Dawn of the Motor Age in the American City, published in 2008 by the MIT Press. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you, Diane.
What led you to write your book, Fighting Traffic?
Well, there was a story in my life that kind of influenced it. One thing was I had a job in a nearby city, and I had to go to it every day. And at the time, I didn't have a car, and I would ride the bus to work. And it dawned on me that the whole world I was traveling through on this bus had been made for single-occupancy vehicles and their drivers, and that as a bus rider, I felt always at a disadvantage to them, and they seemed really well accommodated. And the city I went to looked like it had been rebuilt for cars. It was about half parking lots. And I began to wonder how that came about. And when I started looking in books and so on, I didn't find the answers that I was looking for. So I started digging around myself.
What was the prevailing model of how city streets were to be used in the beginning of the 20th century?
Well, I think if you went back 100 years ago, people thought of city streets a lot like we today think of city parks. They were places where you could go and do what you want, provided you didn't get in other people's way or endanger them or make a nuisance out of yourself. And that's really a very different way of looking at streets than we have today.
So what would the street look like if you were observing it in that time?
Well, fortunately, they had photography, and you can see it. And I looked at hundreds or probably thousands of pictures, and what I saw was a place that physically was recognizable as a street with sidewalks and a pavement, but that was also extremely different in very striking ways. For one thing, 100 years ago, you really saw pedestrians all over the street, everywhere. There were no crosswalks, no center lines. In a lot of ways, people were expected to be in streets because right down the middle of the street in practically every city, large and small, was the track for a streetcar. And people, to get on or get off the streetcar, had to go into the middle of the street, and they usually had to do it in the middle of the block. So actually, it was built into the system that pedestrians would be in the middle of the street. You'd also see all kinds of other things that you don't see anymore. You'd see children playing. You would see children working, shining shoes, selling newspapers, selling gum. You'd see vendors with their carts, their push carts. You would see bicyclists, somewhat like you would see today. And beginning right about 100 years ago, you were starting to see automobiles as well, and they were all sharing this space.
How did the introduction of automobiles and their increasing use in the streets affect the users?
Well, of course, that would depend on the users. For example, if you were a pedestrian, you would suddenly notice that you had to pay a lot more attention to where you stepped into the street. Because before the car, if you stepped into the street, if a horse-drawn vehicle was approaching, it was approaching slowly. Same with a streetcar. You had time. What was different about the car was its speed. And they were not fast by our standards. They were probably typically going something like 20 miles an hour, but that was double the speed of anything on the road before and enough to cause a real problem. I mean, the only comparable problem like it was bicycles, which were also pretty new, and there were a lot of pedestrians who were angry at what they called bicycle scorchers, which were people who went fast on bicycles. But the difference, of course, was that if a car hit you, you were going to the hospital or worse.
When automobiles and motorists began appearing on city streets, how were they viewed by the other groups who use the streets?
Well, the answer to that will come to you if you remember what a street was perceived as 100 years ago. It's a shared space where everybody's welcome, provided they don't obstruct others or make danger out of themselves. And from that point of view, all the problems connected with cars and city streets were automatically blamed on the car and its driver in a way that is totally different from what we would do today. You know, 100 years ago, if a car hit a child at play in the street, the assumption was instant that the motorist was at fault and would be severely blamed for it. And of course, today everybody is wondering, who let this child play in the street? What's wrong with the parents of this kid? So it was a very different outlook. And one thing that struck me very forcefully when I started looking in local sources in cities of 80 to 100 years ago was just how angry people were. They were very upset at what was happening in the streets, and their blame was really directed at motorists.
And what were some of the terms that they used to describe motorists?
Well, they were very inventive in their vocabulary. A popular one was juggernaut, which was named for a Hindu god to which children were sacrificed, allegedly, who was paraded around streets on a wheeled vehicle. So there was an analogy there. They were sometimes called Moloch, which was an Old Testament Canaanite deity who was also the recipient of child sacrifice. So in both cases, the car is being looked at as a pagan idol to which children are sacrificed. Also, it was compared to the Grim Reaper. If you look in newspapers 80 to 100 years ago, I would say you see more Grim Reapers driving cars than you see Uncle Sam's. So that was a very common one as well. Joyrider meant something a little different than it does today. A joyrider was anybody going fast in city streets. So there was a lot of blame, and there were terms to describe these reckless motorists.
How did this attitude and also the prevailing model of how streets had been used threaten the emerging auto industry?
Well, since everybody was automatically blaming the motorist and the car, and by everybody I mean especially pedestrians and especially parents of children, well, this made the car look pretty bad. And this in itself was a threat to people who made their living selling cars in cities. And by that I mean mostly local auto dealers, but also auto clubs and manufacturers too. And they saw this as a threat to their business, quite understandably. And the logical thing to do if you blame motorists for the problem is to restrict them. And some measures for restricting cars and their drivers, from the point of view of people who wanted to sell cars, were just draconian. One example was laws requiring cars to have governors installed on their engines that would shut the engine off if it hit 20 or 25 miles an hour. There was a proposal for just such a law in Cincinnati in 1923. 42,000 people signed petitions for it. And from the point of view of people who wanted to sell cars, this was doom, because they figured, why do people buy cars? They buy them because they go faster than any of the alternatives. You put a speed governor on them and you lose that one decisive advantage. And so from their point of view, really beginning about that time, early 20s, they saw that their future depended on redefining the problem in such a way that the motorist was not automatically guilty every time a pedestrian was struck by a car. There would have to be some way of sharing the responsibility, giving pedestrians and even children part of the blame in case of accidents. And then that way it would be possible to keep selling cars in cities.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Peter Norton, assistant professor in the Department of Science, Technology, and Society at the University of Virginia, and author of the book Fighting Traffic, The Dawn of the Motor Age in the American City. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP, 90.3 FM Seattle, and on the web at kexp.org. What was the new model of what streets are for that ultimately prevailed and was fostered by auto interests, the one that we see today?
Yes, it is the one we see today, and it really began in the 20s. And I think you used the phrase new model, and I think it's important to realize what that means. It means that what a street is for was not some automatic natural thing, you know, like a natural phenomenon. It was, in fact, something that people had to agree upon and shape and influence and change. And so if the old model was that a street was like a city park, the new model had to be something that would give motorists more legitimacy in streets so that they actually belonged there, which is hard to do because the minute you have people driving cars over, say, 20 or 25 miles an hour in streets, other people's access to the street is automatically diminished because it's unsafe at a minimum and a nuisance to drivers as well. So the new model, if it was going to give a place to motorists and streets, would have to be a really radical change. And it took the people who wanted to sell cars in cities a while to figure this out. But once they figured it out, they worked very successfully and very hard to change it. And so they had to, first of all, change the idea that a city street is open to everybody. You know, the old idea was a city street's public space paid for by the public, everybody belongs in it. Well, they began to redefine city streets as motor thoroughfares, places for cars. And in fact, one of the most effective ways of doing this was to actually start paying for the streets, because when you pay for something, you can claim ownership in it. And you can really measure this, because gasoline taxes were introduced around 1918, and the auto industry and auto dealers and clubs hated them for a few years. And then in the early 20s, when they saw this threat to their future in cities because of the blame they were getting for all of the accidents to pedestrians and children, they said, look, what if we accept gasoline taxes? What if we pay them and we write into the laws that enact gasoline taxes that the revenues for them will go into street building and maintenance and road building and maintenance? Then we will have something close to ownership of the roads. And when we've got that, well, then we can claim that roads are bought and paid for by motorists and therefore belong to the motorist. So this was one of, several strategies that by the late 20s, certainly by 1930, was helping the auto people to claim that the streets are for them.
Would you discuss the origin of the term jaywalking and how it was used to change our ideas about who is entitled to use the street and how the street may be used?
Certainly. This is a fantastic little example of how the people who wanted to sell cars in cities could redefine streets as places for motorists. Because, okay, remember, 100 years ago, everybody's walking in the street wherever they want. We would call these people jaywalkers today. Nobody called them jaywalkers 100 years ago. For one thing, because the term was extremely rare, almost nobody had heard of it outside of the Midwest, and even there it was rare. There was a total revolution, and within 10 or 20 years, everybody had heard of this word, and some resented it, but it entered the mainstream language, and it's a story that's really totally unknown and really wonderfully captures this whole revolution. The word first appeared, as far as I can tell, in the Midwest about 100 years ago, and in very early usages, it describes someone from the country visiting the big city, dazzled by the show windows, and this pedestrian from the country is looking in the show windows and blocking other pedestrians on the sidewalk. This is not our idea of jaywalking today, of course, but the people who wanted to sell cars in cities, auto dealers, auto clubs, and so on, they saw an opportunity here. If they could use this word as a term of ridicule against pedestrians who got in the way of automobiles, they could really help to legitimize motorists' place in the city street while at the same time delegitimizing the pedestrians' place in the city street. I would say 100 years ago, probably 99% of Americans had never heard of this word. That totally changed because of the automobile interests. And they began to organize safety campaigns in cities to reduce accidents. And as parts of these safety campaigns, they would promote the use of this word. One of the more cost-effective ways of doing this was to get Boy Scouts to do it. And they printed up thousands of little cards. They looked like business cards. They were different in different cities, but they typically said something like, "Did you know you were jaywalking on them?" And they would define the term and illustrate what is meant by the word. And Boy Scouts would hand this out to pedestrians who were doing what they had always done in city streets, which was cross them wherever they wanted or just walk in them. And we know that the pedestrians who got them didn't know they were jaywalking because the card defined the term, and also because newspaper articles about these campaigns sometimes revealed that the pedestrian's attitude was one of shock or annoyance at getting these little cards. But it was a wonderfully effective way of getting the word out. And also as part of these campaigns, clowns were dressed up to look like fools, and they would wear sandwich boards that said, "I am a jaywalker." In one case, one of these clowns was even repeatedly struck by a slow-moving Model T as part of a safety parade. And the idea was to get people to laugh at the stupid jaywalker, and this would gradually get people to accept the idea that walking wherever you want in the city street is actually not okay, and it's only a practice of fools. And the success of this campaign is really measured by the fact that by 1924, the word, which was virtually unknown a few years before, was in an American English dictionary for the first time and was starting to make its way into city traffic ordinances as well.
Would you say more about how the changing attitudes towards who is responsible for safety in the streets, how that helped bring about the motor age?
Well, you can't have a motor age, by which I mean an age where we expect people to get around chiefly by automobiles in a world built for automobiles. You can't have it if you've got all kinds of people using streets all the time wherever they want. So it was absolutely necessary to redefine the city street as a place for motor vehicles before you could have the motor age. And maybe one of the most effective ways of achieving that was to get into the classrooms of America. If you go back to 1920, there was not much safety education in schools, and what there was mostly about fire safety, also some public health instruction, and a little bit of traffic safety was often sort of a bloody scare tactics that had a way, from the automobile's point of view, of making cars look like the demons they were being portrayed as by so many other people as well. The American Automobile Association was a big player in changing all that. For one thing, they took safety patrols, which already existed and which would often stop cars to direct children to cross the street, and they took over the safety patrols by funding them and supplying the belts and badges and so on. And from that point on, the children would wait on the street until there were no cars, and then the patrol kid would escort the children across the street. They also got in the classrooms and gave free safety curricula to all the public schools of America and free safety posters. And they really changed the whole technique of teaching safety. Number one was teach children that the streets are for automobiles. And this was just drummed in relentlessly. For example, you could get a coloring book in school at that time, and you would color in pictures of children playing on the playground away from the street, and as they colored, you would be reading the text that said, the street is for autos. And it was a sort of redefinition of streets right at the most basic level, which is at the level of the children. And the hope was that the children would take this message home to their parents, who were a lot harder to change. They were, you know, teaching old dogs new tricks is always hard. So the idea was change the children, and you've got the future.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Peter Norton, Assistant Professor in the Department of Science, Technology, and Society at the University of Virginia, and author of the book Fighting Traffic, The Dawn of the Motor Age in the American City. Would you comment also on the efforts by auto interests to bring about rejection of the idea that speed and safety are mutually exclusive?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I mentioned the speed governor idea earlier. This was the idea that if you could make streets safe if cars actually physically couldn't go more than, say, 20 miles an hour. And, of course, there's an assumption behind that, which is that the speed of the car is what makes it dangerous. Now, that assumption was viewed as very dangerous to people who wanted to sell cars, because they saw that as the number one reason why people buy cars is because they go faster than all of the alternatives. So they could see by the early 20s that the automatic connection between safety and speed was actually dangerous to the auto industry. So they began to try to dissociate these two things and to blame instead a reckless minority of motorists as well as careless pedestrians and redistribute the responsibility away from just fast motorists. It's a bit like the old NRA campaign, people kill people, guns don't kill people, which you may recall. This is similar. In other words, fast cars don't kill people. You know, reckless pedestrians and reckless drivers kill people. So it was a very fundamental shift that helped legitimize the purported safe, fast driver. And they proposed a very different way of dealing with making fast cars safe, and that was to rebuild roads in such a way that you could drive fast and still not hurt anyone. This coincided really nicely with the gasoline tax idea, because the gasoline taxes usually went to state highways. And the idea was, if you took these state highways paid for by gas taxes and you put them right through cities, well, now you could have a road that was as fast as a country highway going into cities. You don't allow pedestrians on them, so you can't hit any of them, and you've suddenly made speed and safety compatible. That's in an era when safety was equated with pedestrian safety, because that was the large majority of the victims of accidents at that time. So in the new concept, you can actually build roads where speed can be safe. And the extreme of this was a claim that you could build, quote, foolproof highways, which turned out to be a big mistake to call them that, because it attracted a lot of foolish driving that actually made them extremely dangerous for a while. But we still live today with the basic concept that you can design a highway in such a way that speed is not dangerous. And this is actually the fundamental principle of highway engineering.
In the early part of the 20th century, how did the different street users view congestion and how it should be addressed? And how did that develop over time?
Well, this goes back again to what's a street for. If you view a street as a place for mixed use, including pedestrians and streetcars and so on, well, a certain amount of congestion is inevitable. But the worst kind would be the kind where you have congestion, but you're not actually moving a lot of people. And from that point of view, the worst thing you could do to a city street was put a lot of cars on it for a couple of reasons. One is the car used, about 100 square feet per person at a minimum, while if you were on a streetcar, you were just using a couple of square feet. And not only that, but the car, to be useful in the city, you had to park it. And once you parked a car, you're not moving anybody. And parked cars were already lining both sides of American city streets by the teens. And this was viewed by most people, including the first generation of traffic engineers, as a colossal waste of street capacity and as really disastrous congestion. And the natural solution from their point of view was to get people out of their cars. And usually the engineer's idea was that the best way to do that is just to ban parking. And so they would try to ban parking wherever they could. Naturally, motorists objected, but most people, I think, went along with this because most people weren't driving yet. But kind of like the old assumption that the motorist is to blame for safety problems, the assumption that the motorist is to be blamed for congestion as well was another threat to the future of the car in the city. And so congestion had to be redefined. And this was done mainly by changing what you count. You know, if you wanted to count traffic flow in the teens or early 20s, you would count number of people moved by the various modes of transportation. By the late 20s, they were already just counting vehicles. And if you count vehicles, then suddenly, you know, the car is not the problem. It is actually what you are trying to move. And if you count vehicles, suddenly the streetcar looks a lot worse because, you know, that's one vehicle and it's big and it's not very maneuverable, and it becomes a big nuisance to the new majority of vehicles. So by changing what you count from moving people to moving vehicles, you really fundamentally change the congestion problem.
In what way might your book inform our current efforts to deal with congestion and issues of transportation infrastructure?
Well, I think the main one is it'll help us look again at some assumptions we tend to make, and particularly some assumptions about things we think are natural but maybe aren't so natural and inevitable. For example, I think a prevailing idea that you find out there is that this is a problem we have chosen as a culture. In other words, we as a culture love automobiles. You often hear this phrase, the love affair, Americans' love affair with the car, as being at the root of this problem. And incidentally, that phrase was just as much an invention of Detroit as jaywalking was earlier. The love affair thesis was invented by Detroit in 1961. That's another story. But it turns out that the idea that we prefer to go by car and prefer to drive alone and love our cars so much that we're willing to transform our entire environment around the needs of the car is really not the inevitable thing, and it's not necessarily a cultural constant in America. Because if you go back to that early period, say the early 20s, the prevailing idea was that cars don't make a lot of sense in cities, that cars do make sense for rural people, because if you live in a farmhouse, there's not going to be a bus or a streetcar stopping by you, and you have the space for a car. But the attitude 80 to 90 years ago was, you can't really have cars in cities because they just use up too much space and they're too dangerous. I think what that teaches us is that our notion that we are attached to driving alone in cars in cities is actually something we were sort of coaxed into accepting rather than something we naturally fell into. And our mental outlook was redefined in such a way that we grew to accept this as natural. We can adjust again. I think we can adjust again to the idea that a city street can be a place, at least some city streets can be places for bicyclists and pedestrians and street railways, buses, or other mixed uses. And I think actually we very much need to be looking towards such a redefinition, since the future doesn't look good for driving alone, not just because gasoline prices may double again in the next 10 years and we may eventually run out of it, also because we've got to do something about carbon emissions, and also because if we look at what we've done to our cities for the sake of the automobile, it looks like we've made ourselves servants of the automobile rather than having the automobile be the servants of us.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
We went through a big adjustment in the early 20s especially, where we accepted the idea that we should rebuild our cities for automobiles. We can go through a similar readjustment mentally, socially, psychologically, and technologically, where we can make ourselves and our needs as human beings preeminent again.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
It's been a pleasure, Diane.
We have just been speaking with Peter Norton, assistant professor in the Department of Science, Technology, and Society at the University of Virginia, and author of the book Fighting Traffic, The Dawn of the Motor Age in the American City, published in 2008 by the MIT Press. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.